Welcome to Native America Calling from Studio 49 in Albuquerque. I'm Tara Gatewood. When people push the envelope, they're often celebrated for creating something new. But that's not always the case when people are pushed out of their comfort zone and are exposed to something different than what they expected, like in the Native art world. Eyebrows often raise when there's an absence of imagery or certain designs that are commonly associated with Native people. Today we'll hear from some Native artists who are changing expectations right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Oil will keep flowing through the Dakota Access Pipeline for now, but that could change by this fall. After a status hearing Wednesday, a federal judge says he'll make a decision as early as September on whether or not to shut off the pipeline. Dasha Eaton reports.
U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg's decision on whether to halt oil flow in the controversial pipeline will likely come by September. Both sides will submit written arguments while federal officials work on a more substantial environmental review. Last week, Boasberg ruled the Army Corps of Engineers failed to complete a proper environmental analysis before issuing permits for the pipeline. The ruling says the Army Corps did not adequately consider the possible impacts of an oil spill where the pipeline passes under the Missouri River, the drinking water source for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. In addition, the ruling said the Corps failed to take into account how a spill might affect fishing rights, hunting rights, or environmental justice, or the degree to which the pipeline's effects are likely to be highly controversial. The project led to months of demonstrations near the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota last year, and hundreds were arrested. Developer Energy Transfer Partners announced earlier this month that it started shipping oil to customers. The company maintains the 1,200-mile pipeline is safe, but tribes in the Dakotas fear environmental harm and brought the lawsuit with help from nonprofit law firm Earth Justice. There have already been several small spills along the pipeline. For National Native News, I'm Dasha Eaton.
The fate of Native American mascots at four Oregon school districts is being decided. The State Board of Education will review the proposals at their Thursday meeting, as KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
The districts are Rogue River, Philomath, Siletz, and Amity. All have agreements with the Confederated Tribes of the Siletz Indians on making their mascots culturally appropriate and relevant for their region. Cindy Hunt, Government and Legal Affairs Manager for the Oregon Department of Education, says if all four agreements are ratified, there will be eight districts total with tribally approved mascots.
They have enthusiastically invited the tribe in to do professional development of their staff, do speeches to assemblies, and really talk about the history of the Native peoples who lived in their school districts. To characterize the agreements as just mascot agreements is really not describing the breadth of these agreements.
There were 15 districts with Indian mascots in 2012 when the legislature approved a resolution requiring a local tribe's involvement. Hunt says only three have not officially told education officials what they're planning. Schools not in compliance risk losing state funding if they have not acted by July 1st. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon.
Federal officials recently apologized for their role in the World War II internment of Unungan people. Jim Kurth, acting director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, traveled to St. Paul Island to speak with survivors and descendants.
As much as we wish, we cannot take back the course of history. But what we can do now is heal together.
Fish and wildlife agents oversaw the internment of the people of the Pribilof Islands. They were sent to camps in southeast Alaska, where many perished due to illness and starvation after the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor in 1942. Nearly 900 Alaska Native people were evacuated from the Aleutian and Pribilof Islands. U.S. New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich reintroduced a bill Wednesday to prohibit the export of sacred Native American items and increase penalties. The Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony, or STOP Act, was originally introduced in 2016. A field hearing on the bill was held last year in Albuquerque. New Mexico tribes are among those in support of the legislation, as many work to bring sacred items home. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Let's say you come from a renowned Native family that has a long legacy in making some of the most shiny and dazzling jewelry that's helped shape the world's perception on what you'll find when you reach for Native jewelry. And plenty of members in your family have won numerous blue ribbons for their squash blossoms, bow guards, and concho belts. What if this is your family's legacy, but your real passion is making things with spikes or 14-karat gold creations with diamonds and rubies, where the only mainstream relatable Native image is a solid circle? What kinds of challenges, obstacles, criticisms do you have to face in order to put out what inspiration and creativity has gifted you? What if you're the Native artist who wants to create figures for canvas that depict an elephant in a suit holding a martini glass, or a pig dancing in a top hat? Just how accepting is the world when you say creations like these are Native art? Share your thoughts at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And are you the Native artist who says no to feathers and step designs? Did you get pushback because your work does not resemble what the public feels is traditional Native work? And have you slashed your way through this cloud only to find a mass of art lovers waiting for your arrival? We want to hear about that too. Our number is 1-800-996-2848, and we look forward to hearing what everyone is thinking. As always, you can tweet your thoughts. Our Twitter handle is at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And here in Studio 49 today, to get us started, we have Pat Pruitt. He is a metalsmith from the Pueblo of Laguna. Pat, it's our pleasure to welcome you here to Studio 49.
Thank you, Tara. And thank you, everybody out there. Ke tāstre trase upa.
And Pat, you know, I went through a couple of scenarios, and maybe there's moments in those instances that you can relate to, or fellow artist, of you have a passion that doesn't quite match exactly what people think when they think about Native art, whether it be jewelry, sculptures, or painting, or any kind of medium. I'm interested about feelings that you have about that, or feelings you get when people are met with something that maybe they're not expecting when they think they're looking at Native art.
Well, that's a great question, Tara. I think from my perspective, being a metalsmith and primarily concentrating on jewelry, when it comes to feeling, and I like to use the term empowerment, you know, because I think for jewelers especially, and it may differ in other artists' mediums, whether you're a painter or a sculptor or a photographer, but with jewelers, one of the things that we can witness is individuals' reactions when they put on jewelry, you know, because it just gives us this empowerment, this embodiment of something and whatever it is that means to them. So that's one of the greatest rewards. You know, you see it when you visit your peers and you're trying on their jewelry. It's like, wow, this makes me feel amazing, you know. And it may be something as simple as a bracelet, or it could be something pretty extreme like a collar, you know. So, I mean, when we start talking feelings, I think there's two different types, right? There's what the person who's wearing feels, and there's what the artist feels, like myself, and how I try to approach the creative aspect on the work that I do, you know. So I really try and look for that, and that empowerment really is really where you're trying to shoot for, that beautification, because we're creating from a jeweler's perspective is we're creating adornment. We want you to feel beautiful.
And so describe your work a little, because it isn't all squash blossoms and concho belts. There's belts, but maybe not what you expect.
Right. So I've done, concho belts and squash blossoms, but in a very different perspective, coming from a very different perspective. To give you a little bit of my history, I was actually kind of fell into doing jewelry due to a bike accident when I was young. I was 15, crashed on a bike, knocked out 7 teeth, fractured my skull, and was laid up for quite some time. So I had the fortunate opportunity to study under Greg Lewis, who is a metalsmith, is a traditional metalsmith out in the Pueblo of Laguna and in the village of Powati specifically. Then a couple years after that, I got to study with Charlie Bird, who is also in the same village. So we have an amazing village of jewelers. And so I got my start doing silver work, right? Traditional stamp and hammer work. Then fast forward into college, I got into the whole body piercing scene and started making jewelry for the body piercing industry and did that for about 17 years or so. And so that was my introduction into the materials I use today, which are stainless steel and titanium. And so taking a look at where I wanted to go, there was a yearning getting back into doing traditional adornment, but using the material that I'm working with today, which are the stainless steels and the titaniums and the zirconiums. During that time, I was going to school to study mechanical engineering, had some car hobbies, being involved in the body piercing scene, the tattoo scene came along with it, and it really influenced my design style. So that's why you see a lot of the work that I do is very non-typical native motif, right? For me, it's really a factor of design. How cool can you make it? And where does that design inspiration comes from? And for me, and I think for a lot of other artists, it really comes from the life path that you go down.
And so some of the works that you're putting out, there's a lot of sharp edges and different ways of seeing metals and knowing this. And so you do a really great job of it. And I think, anytime you hear people who are looking at your work, they get it. And, a lot of times what we see and what we're attracted to, well, there's a whole backstory on what exactly is attracting us to certain things that artists are making. But when you do get that pushback or the eyebrow raised or somebody kind of pops in at the booth and then they go, oh, mm-mm, and they just kind of walk on by. Talk to me about that. And what does that say to you about these kind of reactions?
Well, reactions can be positive and negative. I think when I start to do more of the extreme stuff, like the designs that you see with some of the spikes or the sharper edges, it's actually pretty amazing because the first response is people think that that's a weapon, right? And if it's a ring, they'll put it on and they'll pretend to punch, whoever their counterpart is with them. And so there's this inherent sense of violence that everybody has and they want to express it through a sharp object when they see it. So you have that response, and then you have the response of sometimes people just don't get it, right? They're like, well, what is that? Well, it's jewelry, and I try and look at it from a perspective of you've got to be able to wear it. It's a very functional item. And then there are those that with some of the extreme designs that they get it. They know where I'm coming from. They know that I want to try and push the metal itself, the materials I'm working with, but also push the boundary of design. Right, on where you really want to take this piece, because you have to look at it from a functional point of view as well as an aesthetic point of view. It's got to look beautiful. It can look extreme, but at the end of the day, it's got to make that person get them back to the feeling, right? They've got to be able to feel it. They got to get it.
All right. And folks, anytime you want to jump into this conversation, we're ready for you. We're going to open up our phone lines now so that we can hear from you. Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And we're going to continue to grow this conversation. Okay, there's a little bit from a jeweler. Now we're going to bring in a painter, an animator, and we're going to go ahead and say hello to them. Joining us today out of Minnesota, we got two of them. In Minneapolis, we have Deani Whitehawk. She's an artist and curator, and she is Sichangu Lakota. Deani, it's our pleasure to welcome you back for another hour. Deani, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Tara. Thanks for having me.
And also with us today from Duluth, we have Jonathan Thunder. He is a painter and animator, and he's a member of the Red Lake Band of Ojibwe. Jonathan, it's our pleasure to bring you into the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks. And so, folks, jump right in there. You know, this thought of reactions or even definitions that people like to put on when we say, what is Native art? Deonnie, go ahead and start us off.
Well, I think the moment that you talked about, or that moment where somebody, you know, walks into your booth or your exhibition or whatever format that may be, and you can see their reactions of you not fulfilling their expectations. I think that's happened to a lot of us, and it's kind of fascinating. There's people out there that understand and recognize Native artists and any other artist of any other group as artists, and that are really genuinely looking for, you know, the most potent forms of expression, you know, in whatever form that may take. And those people are always there, and those people recognize and see are excited by forms of exploration that they're unfamiliar with. That's, but, you know, there are people that are still really looking for Native artists to fulfill their expectations. I think Nancy Mitlow describes it really well. She's a Chiricahua Apache. She's a scholar, and she writes about the American imagination of what Native people are, so this imagined idea of what we are, and that's applied to our art fairly often. And, you know, I've had those experiences where people walk up and just quickly turn around and walk right by because it's not what they're looking for. And you can watch, you know, like, especially at places like, you know, Santa Fe Indian Art Market, you can watch the progression down down booths, and you can see what people are looking for and what they're not, and when yours doesn't fulfill what they're seeking. Or they'll come in and just have these, you know, faces of puzzlement. And it's kind of entertaining, and it's funny, and at the same time, it's sometimes it's a little validating, because you're like, well, good, you know, I'm glad I'm not fulfilling stereotypes for you. I'm glad that, you know, to see that it's making people think and question and wonder. But it's also really interesting, and I'll tell one quick story. Another moment of expectations of Native artists is my husband is always with me when I've done markets in the past. And my husband is from the Southwest. He's Navajo, San Carlos, Apache, and Quechan. And he'll be sitting in the booth with me. And my husband's dark, and I'm light, I'm mixed. And people will come into the booth, and they assume that he's the artist. And I've also had times when they figure out, and he'll introduce them to me. And when they figure that out, I've also had times where then they leave. And it's for that same reaction of, I did not fulfill their expectations of what a Native artist is, of what they're looking for. So there's a lot of different ways, whether or not somebody speaks a language, whether or not somebody's from the reservation or from the city. You know, we have judgment applied to our artistic expression from a variety of different expectations. And it's challenging, but I think it's something that is a part of the field at large, and I think it's a really good thing to be aware of, and it's exciting when people are making those moves to push against those expectations.
And Deonnie, tell us a little bit about your imagery, how you're pushing expectations.
Well, it's funny to me because mine does, but at the same time, like, my subject matter of my work is so strongly grounded in the artistic traditions of Lakota people, and worldviews and thoughts, and, you know, I mean, the narrative behind my work is always really grounded in our culture and our experiences. But I'm an abstract painter, so unless you are really familiar with the aesthetics of Lakota culture, then you may miss those signifiers. But they're always there. So I work in paint. A lot of times paintings mimic beadwork or quillwork or really incorporate what might be understood as like a Lakota color palette. But I also work in beadwork and quillwork and mixed media, where I incorporate those elements into my paintings.
And folks, if you're curious about what any of the art that we're describing today looks like, we have links on our website. If you can see some of these images, both from Pat and Diani and Jonathan, you visit us online, NativeAmericaCalling.com. And let's go ahead and hear from a caller. We have a caller, Ryan, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Ryan, thank you for giving us a ring. And what would you like to share?
Hello, my name is Ryan Singer. I'm Navajo. I just wanted to kind of express what I think of Native art. First of all, you know, I'm Native American, so basically any kind of art that I make is Native art. And I've enjoyed doing all kinds of art since I was a little kid, and I've had influences from like sci-fi movies, horror movies, comic books, all that stuff kind of fused together as I got older, and that's what I enjoyed kind of as a kid, those influences and just kind of like practicing sketching them and then drawing them, and eventually as I became older, it became part of my Native art, I guess, that fused into sort of a traditional kind of Native art, like Southwest Native art with some kind of like Native American identity. And as I do that artwork, I try to tell stories about my life, personal maybe experiences or things that I've seen or heard. And so those paintings that I do now, those are basically little stories of my life. I basically can't really speak about a lot of Native art because I think each Native artist has their own individual take on it, individual style. And I got big, props for a lot of the Native artists that are pushing the envelope and doing really innovative kind of work. So I enjoy looking at other artwork. I enjoy talking with other artists and kind of just seeing what they're up to. But I know everybody has their own idea of what they're, what they're making and how they got to that point, you know. And I enjoy seeing younger artists coming up and trying to do different things, you know, and innovating.
And Ryan, I understand you work with young artists. Is that true?
Yeah, here and there. I do at least three or four different sort of like artist talks, or I'll visit schools and do like projects with younger, like grade school, junior high kids, high school kids, and just do art projects with them.
And Ryan, do you ever engage with them about some of this, or get them prepared for, how art is received, or what's it like when we try and, you know, if we were to have a bunch of young Native kids on this panel today, you know, do we change the dialogue, or do we get them ready, or do we just sit there and listen on what they think about this argument going on, Ryan?
What I would tell them is I would get an education first, go to school and figure out what you want to do with your life as far as, I mean, if you want to do art or if you want to do something else, because education will give you the tools, the knowledge, so that way you can back up your work. You know what I mean? And I went to school and I learned a lot about, like ancient Greek, Egyptian art, all the way up to modern art. And then also I've been influenced by Navajo artwork and Native artwork, you know, that I grew up looking at. So all that stuff kind of like influences my work. So I think it's good to know a lot about, you know, the history of art and where it comes from and how it has evolved over like the centuries. And so I think that's important. I think experiences are important too, like traveling, seeing different things, experiencing different things, trying different foods, meeting with other artists, feeding off of each other, stuff like that. I think it's really important
sure.
for them to experience stuff like that.
Well, it all is woven into the work. Ryan, great to hear from you. Thank you for your call here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And folks, we want you to join us too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Pat, I saw a big smile on your face when I said, what if we were to toss this to young people or mentoring them? I mean, how do we, translate this conversation to them or, you know, what do you think? Go ahead.
Well, I think when we're dealing with the youth and art and creativity, one of the things that we need to factor in is to not inhibit them, right? Because that's where creativity comes from. I mean, you look at children and just their mind is free. It flows. They have absolutely no inhibitions. How do you foster that? How do you foster them remaining uninhibited? Because I think as adults, as part of this conversation that we're having today, we're now talking about stereotypes. We're now talking about producing art that sells, that maybe fits a mold, that may be stereotypical, because as adults, we got to earn a living. And so as we start, or if we want to foster the youth, I think that remaining free is extremely important. I've been very fortunate with the work that I do that I can continue to do that. You know, because I'm really just a big kid these days making some cool stuff. I think with Ryan, and Ryan, props for calling in and thanks for your comments. I think Ryan hit a key thing on understanding and educating as well. Because as artists, one of the things that we kind of fall into as we produce our art and as we become professional artists is understanding the business of art. And that's something that can be learned. But it doesn't come naturally. I mean, it's something that I think all of us that are in this field have had to learn over time through failure, through whatever. But we eventually kind of get it. So I think that's where we need to go with our youth, you know, the education and remain uninhibited.
Very nice. What do you think? Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Deani, we got a minute before break. Anything to add? Oh, okay. Well, that's your turn to add something to the conversation. Folks, we're going to continue with this conversation here. And maybe you're hearing some of this and, you know, you want to call in anonymously because you don't want to step on any toes or you need to vent. Go ahead. Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And when it comes to what is critiqued as not being Native art, where do we take this conversation? Is this something that Native artists need to be defining? And what do you think gets revealed anytime somebody looks at a work that is made by a Native person and they make the comment, that's not Native art? What do you think about that? Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We're also going to hear what Jonathan Thunder has to think about all this. He's a member of the Red Lake Band of Ojibwe. Maybe that's your nation and you're excited to hear what this gentleman has to say. Well, stay tuned. But when you need to, pick up the phone and call in and share your thoughts. 1-800-996-2848. Or you can hop on Twitter and send us a tweet. Maybe you just want to send an image. Feel free. Our Twitter handle is at 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we look forward to anything you'd like to contribute to this hour. We're going to pause for a moment, but our phone lines will stay open so you can call in and share what you're thinking. On the next Native America Calling, we'll discuss common and not so common breaches in powwow etiquette. Is it okay to take pictures of whatever you find beautiful? Does everyone have to stand for grand entry? And when is it okay for visitors to enter and participate in the dance arena? We'll find out on our next hour, and we hope you'll join us.
Support by the Utah Office of Tourism, announcing the Four Corners School of Outdoor Education, offering a wide variety of field-based educational hiking and rafting adventures, including scenic tours of the Bears Ears region. Nearby attractions include Canyonlands National Park, Hovenweep National Monument, Natural Bridges National Monument, Monument Valley Tribal Park, Cedar Mesa, and the San Juan River. Reservations and summer camp scholarship information at fourcornerschool.org.
The Coeur d'Alene Tribe invites you to Jalayance, the largest outdoor powwow in the Northwest, July 20th through the 22nd. Over 100 arts and crafts vendors from around the Northwest. 3 days of dancing, art auctions, drumming competitions, a horse parade, food, and special guests. The Swamp People from History Channel, with no admission cost and $5 for parking. It's Jalayance, July 20th through the 22nd at the Greyhound Park, Post Falls, Idaho. Learn more at 1-800-523-2464 or jalayance.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and we appreciate you joining us today on our discussion about Native art. And Native artists have always created pieces that speak about their personal experience and experiences of the Native community. Native artists use a wide range of materials and styles to express their ideas. So what happens when all this creativity is met with the response, "That's not Native art"? What then? Tell us about it. That's our conversation today. Give us a ring at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We look forward to hearing what you think about all this. And we're going to bring our guests back into the conversation. Here in Studio 49 today, we have Pat Pruitt. He's a metalsmith from the Pueblo of Laguna. Also on the line from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Deani Whitehawk, and she's an artist and curator, and she is Sichangu Lakota. It's our pleasure to welcome them back, and we're going to bring in Jonathan Thunder now from Duluth, Minnesota, a member of the Red Lake Band of Ojibwe. And Jonathan, thank you for being with us as well. And go ahead, any thoughts, because I know we put a lot on the table.
Hey, Tara. Thank you. So I guess, you know, I've heard a lot of good things and a lot of important things said by Pat, Deani, and Ryan, who called in, and three people that I know their work, and I think their perspective is very valuable. I personally sort of feel like I'm coming from a place where I can only speak on my own experience in the art world. And I can definitely relate to some of those instances that I heard. I've always tried to personally just come from my own individual narrative, you know, as an individual. And I think that so often in Native art, in the Native art scene, both by non-Natives and Native individuals, there's a push. There's a push to go in a certain direction. And often that push is based on, you know, it's based on what's popular, it's based on money, it's based on what people will think that will make, you know, the gallery successful. And, you know, that's the hard truth about art, is that it quickly becomes a business when you're, you know, you're looking at your last ramen packet in the cabinet. And for me, I've had to come up with some pretty inventive ways to support myself and try to stay true to my individual story. And a lot of my paintings are just personal stories, stories of my lens as I see it through the world. And that lens is whether or not the image is of a pink elephant or if it's of a, you know, a Thunderbird woman. Anywhere in that scope, that lens is through the eyes of a Native man walking around in this world. So you get what you get, you know, and you get that flavor. And there have been days where when I was pushed into a box, I wanted to, like, push away from that flavor. But I've taken a stance where I try to be more fluid. I think there's a lot of artists. There's a lot of Native artists now, and there's so much awareness about all the different Native artists that we have that there's now room. There's now room to breathe. We can sit in that box if that's our safe spot, or we can get out of there for a little while and go venture around. And, you know, if you decide to come back to that at any given point, because that's what you call home. You know, you should have that right. And I think that, you know, with the artists that I'm seeing today, and the artists that are making a push to not be so obvious, I think we're in a good place, because I feel like I can breathe. Somebody asked me the other day if I felt like I had a responsibility to push against that Native American traditional imagery, and I don't think I do. I think maybe at one point I thought I did, but I think nowadays I feel like, you know, I can do my own thing, you know, and if one day I'm feeling like extra, you know, extra Indian, then I can, you know, I can paint in that style.
Are those often Wednesdays?
On Wednesdays, usually I'm just probably in search of a burrito and someplace warm to sit.
And with that, Jonathan, and share a little bit more for somebody who is curious and is wondering, okay, well, if there are different types of ways to approach art as a Native, do they get along? You know, do people stand on one side of the room if you do a certain kind of art and you stand on the other? Give us the reality of it, of the camaraderie or maybe the lack of camaraderie when you're making certain things in the Native art world. What do you think?
I think there unfortunately are definitely lines drawn in the sand. I think it's probably not anybody's fault. There is a certain draw for humans to go towards familiarity. And like I said, I'm only speaking on my own personal experience. I've never felt like I was part of any club. And I kind of like that. You know, I think art is an expression of individuality. And for me, I feel like that lets me know that I'm doing it right. Sometimes I get to play, but often I find myself, you know, basically supporting myself through my animation work. And that animation work, I make cartoons also, and those feed my paintings a lot. So I have the luxury of not having to really subscribe to either club. But I do see that, you know, I do see the clubs forming, and I like clubs. But I like to be able to go home at the end of the day, too.
Very nice. I appreciate you sharing your take. We got a caller on the line. Maybe you also want to join this conversation. We'd like to have you. Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We're going to say hi to Carlton in Zuni, New Mexico, listening on KSHI. Carlton, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Hello, everybody. I just wanted to share a quick story about what the reactions were from the general public when I started doing the contemporary jewelry, Zuni jewelry. And I purposely started marketing contemporary jewelry as a business reason, and that because the Zuni jewelry market was flooded with so-called traditional Zuni jewelry. So when I started doing contemporary Zuni jewelry and started doing some of the retail shows, the reaction from the general public was not a very good one. It was very confrontational. People would come up to my booth and say, "This isn't Zuni jewelry. You're not supposed to be doing this type of work. You're supposed to make traditional jewelry." And it was very hard to explain why I'm doing this, or trying to explain that it is Zuni jewelry, because I am Zuni and I created the work. And I was just wondering if any of the artists on the show today have any similar experiences.
Ah, okay. Carlton, thank you for your call. Let's take it to the jeweler, jeweler to jeweler. Pat Pruitt, any thoughts for Carlton?
Hey, Carlton, what's going on, man? Glad you called in.
Yeah, going good.
So, yeah, no, I mean, like, mad props, dude, because I see the work that you're doing, and you're exploring the stainless steels and the titaniums with also with some advanced technology, right? Because you're doing some water jet cutting and using some tools that are really outside of the scope of what most jewelers
have in their studios. So, you know, hats off, because I think that's part of the next part of the dialogue with what we're faced with as Native artists is how does technology influence our ability to produce art? You know, because I think we're at a stage now where a lot of the technology is becoming more and more affordable, and it's becoming, or you have easier access to create things that you may not have been able to create before. So I applaud you on your effort and moving forward with a lot of that work that you're doing these days.
All right, Carlton, thank you for your call. Again, join us at 1-800-996-2848. And a large part of what I'm hearing is coming from reactions from people, you know, in the market scene, or maybe we can even extend it into galleries and museums. I'm also curious, what about just among Native people? Are we hearing the same kind of reactions, or do Native people, are they enjoying it, or are they saying, it's about time I saw something like this? I'm wondering about that side, too. Diani, anything you want to share on that?
Yeah, I'll answer that question quickly and then just kind of in response to what everybody has said. Yes, that pushback comes from both Native and non-Native people. And it really depends on the individual and what their goals and values are in their own work and or their goals and values in what they see. And it also varies from community to community, tribe to tribe. I think, there's different value systems and different ways of living and different world experiences, there's no cookie cutter pattern from one place to the next. So, but one thing that I hear, and I've loved everything that each person has shared on here, and one thing that I really try to explain to both Native and non-Native audiences in regards to our art that applies to everything everybody has said is that if you take the time, get that education and take the time and utilize the resources that are out there to look at the trajectory of the historic works of our ancestors, of each tribe, you'll see that nothing has ever stood still. The production of artistic expression is always changing and has always changed. And it changes. You can watch each time new materials became available in certain communities or new techniques became available in certain communities, artists took and ran and embraced those new materials and new techniques and new ways of making things. And they incorporate them into already established artistic expressions. So metalsmithing is an example of that. You know, there may be traditional aspects of that that have things that have become traditional, but that's a technique that has not been there forever, as is beads. You know, beads are a trade item. Wool is a trade item. German and silver sequins are trade items. You can see the historic responses to new materials all the time. And now Jonathan and Pat and myself and Ryan and everybody who's chimed in are all continuing to do the same thing that our ancestors have done. You know, we're taking and responding to the materials at hand and our life experiences and our environments today. And from our life experiences as Native people who are also American citizens and, you know, live in this world with, you know, shared lives with everybody else that's here, you know, we respond to those experiences with the materials and the techniques we have at hand. And our ancestors did the same thing. I think it's also, you know, I think there's value in, and I think it's important, those, you know, arts that really stick to carrying traditions forward. I really value those people, and I think that knowledge that they bring with them is so important, and we need that continuity. But we also need those people that are pushing, and we need, you know, that entire spectrum in between there. It's all important, and there's room for all of it.
Sure. And, you know, a lot of the items that people would put into a traditional category, at the end of the day, when we return to our home communities or we participate in ceremony, there are certain things that you do have to have. And if those traditions aren't being carried on, you know, what will we do? A lot of great things that you brought up, Diani, as well as all of our guests. And if there's something more you want to add to this conversation, give us a ring, 1-800-996-2848. We're going to go now to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to say hello to Manuela Well-Off Man. She is the chief curator at the Institute of American Indian Arts, Museum of Contemporary Native Arts. Manuela, thank you for being with us today. And a lot of people turn to this particular place to gain support, or a lot of times this is where they can find some of the artists who are making different styles. Is there anything you'd like to share about why we have to support Native artists no matter what they're making?
Hello, Tara. Thank you so much for having me. And I invite your listeners and everybody to come to IAA Museum of Contemporary Native Arts, because our museum is the only museum in this country who solely really focuses on contemporary Native art. So we have a long history of supporting contemporary Native art. Artists are welcome to submit their portfolios, and our exhibition history also shows that contemporary Native art is important, but there's also room for both. I mean, it's true what Diani just said. Native art has constantly been in flux and ever-changing and has always been developing, and artists don't live in isolation. To me, as a curator, I find art especially interesting when I see that art really reflects our really complex world. Modern world, modern Indian reality is very complex, and I think art should reflect that. And many artists find inspiration in traditional art forms, and then a really powerful tool can be to distort those traditions or refine those traditions, revive those traditions. I think there is really a space for both, you know, contemporary and traditional art forms in our contemporary art world.
And Manuela, what role do you think that museums and galleries play in making sure that they are considering different art forms or different ways of expressing, or just even opening the doors to how people are seeing their world as Native people in the current day? You know, what role do these institutions have in making sure there's space for them?
Yeah, one of the roles is definitely also educating the public, and we do this through exhibitions and didactics. I think especially with contemporary art, Native or non-Native, it's important to provide information through wall text, panels, labels, audio tours, guided tours, and really I think another role is we need to provide space for a wide variety of art forms, and really promote contemporary Native art. There is still a lot of work to do. I mean, IAIA Mokna has a long history, and when you come to our museum, you will see that continual risk-taking and innovation has a tradition here, and it has shaped our institution. But I think what we need to work on is really getting mainstream museums and mainstream art institutions excited. And now there is an interest among non-Native curators. Sometimes it's just, you know, the hesitation, will I do the right thing? And it's a matter of reaching out to them and helping them. But I think we have made great progress, and I really think it's one of our main roles is to promote contemporary Native art.
Sure. And you know, education is an important thing. And Diani, we just covered an issue with an art museum where, you know, there wasn't a lot of consideration of what, you know, how Natives are weaving into what's being put out there in Minneapolis. And Diani, I also understand that you do curating. Is there anything you want to share to places to really start thinking about? Don't forget about some of the works we're talking about today. Or even challenging them to put them right next to what they consider traditional art. Diani, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. There's people that are, you know, Native curators, artists, scholars, historians that are working today and have been, you know, people that have come before us that have really been paving the way to try and make sure that Native voices are heard. And within our own field, within the Native arts field, you know, that the variety of those voices are embraced, that the complexity of those voices are embraced and written about and validated. But also, you know, there's a lot of work being done to try to make sure that our voices are included in the larger arts field, and within mainstream institutions and academia, and that our voices are seen and heard and woven into the conversation regularly, because for the most part, we're often still one of the most underrepresented populations within the larger arts field. So, you know, I do really encourage people to, you know, if there's any non-Native folks out there that are in the arts field that are listening, you know, to think about the ways that Native arts have influenced the output of American art, the way that Native arts continue to be an essential part of our country's artistic history, and remember to include and uplift our voices within that conversation, because it's vitally important to do, to really, you know, be honest and tell the whole inclusive story of this land base.
Thanks, Diani. Jonathan, any final thoughts?
Final thoughts? Yeah, I would just say, you know, it's. I think it's important that we all just kind of like hold hands and step forward, kind of like what Manuela was saying. Just work together to get everybody on board with, you know, the progress. Keep moving forward.
All right. Thank you for that. And Pat, we turn to you. Any final comments about, you know, just how do we move forward from this conversation?
So moving forward from this conversation, one of the things that we need to understand is we're now at a point in time where we have very successful Native artists. You know, we have Tony Abeda, who just recently curated a show, Neo-Native Towards New Mythologies. You know, Tony Abeda, amazing painter, and he's accepted that leadership responsibility, you know, to push forward. And I think as Native artists, if we have that opportunity to lead the way and not sit back and let things happen, because we've got to take control of our own voice. You know, we have a very unique environment of an art market that specializes in purely Native American art. So how do we move that forward? How do we dictate what the story that's going to be told is going to be, right? Because as we look at things in the past that were contemporary, that were groundbreaking, that were amazing at that point in time, are now considered traditional. So that target keeps moving. So how do we keep evolving it? But it's one of those things that we as artists have to control it. You know, we have to control our destiny and take it where we think it needs to go to help those that are coming behind us not have such a hard time.
And what about even just breaking away from, you know, the full-on Native art scene and making sure Native art is anywhere art is being celebrated?
Right. So that's the next big challenge. Having done non-Native art shows, that's an extremely different environment, right? Because there you're really looking at the aesthetic of the work. Does your work compare? I mean, I call myself a metalsmith because that's what I do, and I've worked in other shows, and a lot of my peers are non-Native artists because the technical level that I'm at, I have to reach outside of this Native art realm to find that help, to find that information from jewelers like James Binion or Chris Plouffe,
These guys who have attained a different level in the materials that are very similar that I work with. So branching out into the non-native field where you're competing with painters, not native painters, but painters. You know, it's a matter of how do you get in there, right? Because it's difficult. It's a highly competitive world. And so do we want to do that? That's the next question, because the native art market is, it's ours. We can control it and we can define it and we can move forward with it in kind of a bubble, right? And we can create amazing artwork. And once we step outside of that environment, do people get it or do people even care, right? Because they're looking at it from a very, just the aesthetic of what you're doing.
Well, I think that's an interesting place to wrap up our hour here. And maybe you have thoughts or comments on that. Carry on the conversation. Do it on Facebook. You can find us. Just look up Native America Calling. You can send us a tweet at 1-800-99-NATIVE. Or perhaps you're finding this conversation in our archive and you wish, I should have called in. Well, guess what? You can still participate because you can comment directly on our website. Just look up today's program, and then there'll be a place to comment at the bottom of the page. And you can also send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com is the email address. And maybe there are more conversations on art that you would like to hear on these Native airwaves. Tell us about it. Reach out to us. We want to hear from you. And that's going to wrap it up for our program today. Thanks again to everybody who participated, all of our callers, as well as our guests, Jonathan Thunder, Deani Whitehat, White Hawk, Pat Pruitt, and also Manuela Well-Off Man. We appreciate everybody's thoughts today. And we hope you'll also join us again tomorrow because it's powwow time. And we are going to turn the full hour over to proper powwow etiquette, or maybe lack thereof. If there's something you'd like to say on that, get ready to call in early. We want to hear from you. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Senior producer is Monica Brain. Associate producer is Andy Murphy. Derek Toledo is our engineer. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm your host and producer, Tara Gatewood, and it has been a pleasure to think about Native art and our tribal communities. Again, if there's more you want to say, we look forward to hearing from you on Facebook, Twitter, and you can also find this program archived on iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks again. We're back tomorrow.
Bonjour. Medicaid, CHIP, and the Marketplace help moms and babies stay healthy. They cover prenatal care, delivery, newborn visits, and breastfeeding help. Sign up today. Call 1-800-318-2596 or visit healthcare.gov. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Miigwech.
Support by the Sioux Trading Post, where our special selection of dried herbs are chosen for superior quality, and many, sage, sweetgrass braids, red willow bark, and cedar, are wildcrafted. All available at SiouxTrading.com. Wopila. The Community Builders STEAM and Cultural Conference for Native Youth by the New Mexico Indian Affairs Department and Los Alamos National Labs at Santa Fe Community College, July 20th to the 22nd. Support by Sundance Consulting at 505-867-0946.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.